Welcome to the Wednesday, March 22nd edition of the radio program, A Record of the John Carlson Show. So nice to have you here. I hope you've gotten our new app that is out there, the new KVI app, which not only allows you to listen to the show on your phone, you can also send us a text message from your phone. You can also send us a audio voice message from your phone. Load it up. Our live studio audience already has it, as you can hear. All right. It is Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen, and you know what that means. Every Wednesday on the John Carlson Show, our legendary song lyric of the week contest. Now, the last few weeks have been kind of challenging, kind of tough. You know, lyrics from Pink Floyd songs and the like. We're going to make this one, I think, relatively easy. Relatively easy. I was test marketing the legendary song lyric with the newsroom out there.
Yeah.
And my friend Tom Hutler got it within seconds.
Lickety split. He was right on it.
So you know how it works. I'm going to give you a lyric from a famous hit song. And when we play that lyric going in or out of commercial break, be the 10th caller. And we've got some wonderful prizes awaiting you. Isn't that true, radio legend?
Well, John, with the move, we kind of put the prizes in a closet somewhere. And I'm still trying to figure out of the 33 closets, which one
right? Okay.
That has the prizes. So I'll get to it. I'll find them.
I think I might have it here.
We have great prizes. We see now you know. Philip J. Yeah. Went to the closet. It was closet 17, by the way. He grabbed the prizes, put them in his drawer so you wouldn't be able to get to them.
It is a $50 Daniel's Broiler gift card.
Nice.
And a Blu-ray combo pack of the movie Devotion. This is the one based on the true story about the two U.S. fighter pilots.
Korean War.
Exactly. Yeah. Jonathan Majors, fantastic actor. Glenn Powell. Both of them emerging superstars.
Yeah.
And they pick really entertaining movies.
And a true story, by the way.
Yeah.
It always helps, a true story. So, anyway, here is your legendary lyric. I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mine.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mind.
Tom Hutler got that?
Sounds like Signs
that
of the...
Within seconds, he got that.
Sounds like Signs of the Patriarchy. I'm sure
Tom plays the mean guitar in places in West Seattle, so I got to believe maybe singer-songwriter.
That's right. Tom Hutler.
Yeah.
Largely unacknowledged but very real rock and roll pedigree. Tom Hutler. Yes, that is true. He's now, of course, the voice
of
the Seattle Mariners at T-Mobile Park for the last generation. And you can hear him on our sister station, but not during 6 to 9.
Yeah, listen when he goes on at 9. Of many talents, though.
He says, when is John Carlson on again? Okay, can I start my show then after that on KNWN? So anyway, there's your legendary lyric. I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mine. Okay. Oh, we've got a great show for you. We got about a 6.5-hour show we're going to wedge into the next 3 hours. Brent Beardall, the CEO of WAFED, is going to jump on with us at 8:35, late in the show, to talk about now that we're more than a week out from all of the trembling and uncertainty about the health of the banking sector. Are things getting better, getting worse, or just in a holding pattern? And also, some people are surmising that regional banks, that smaller banks, local banks, have an uncertain future, even if the industry itself is healthy. So we're going to bounce both those questions off Brent Beardall, who, again, is not only the CEO of WAFED, he very nearly died in a horrific plane crash, took the life of the pilot of the plane sitting right next to him last January, and has made an inspiring recovery from that accident. So it's we had him here in studio last week. It was so great to see him again. Anyway, Brent Beardall going to be joining us at 8:35 on the John Carlson Show. We have our first big poll in the Washington governor's race, and it's already had an impact. Either that or it's an amazing coincidence. One politician who doesn't look who is well known but didn't do well in the poll has already indicated that he will not be running for governor in 2024. We'll tell you more on that coming up on The Commute with Carlson. But speaking of governors, for 3 days, we've been telling you about this massive homeless sweep at the Duwamish River in South Seattle on a drug encampment that was, or I call them crime encampments now, because you know what? That's what holds them together. That's the one common feature, besides the fact that they're not housed, is almost everyone in there is committing crime and has a criminal record. But beyond that, we've been telling you about this homeless encampment down in the industrial area of South Seattle, near the Georgetown neighborhood, kind of cheek by jowl from Boeing and the Duwamish River. It's about the size of 2 football fields, according to journalist Jonathan Cho. And yesterday, Governor Inslee showed up. And, there's the cameras there. And he used that as a platform to talk about his $4 billion housing plan being considered by the legislature, which, by the way, is having a tough time getting traction. Listen to these comments by the governor.
This is the Evergreen State, and we should not ever allow it to become the ever homeless state. This is a scourge in our state, and we cannot allow it to continue.
Governor Inslee saw for himself today the scale of the work that's left to do at the homeless encampment under the First Avenue Bridge.
These encampments, there's no excuse. It is inexcusable to accept Washington with homelessness of this dimension.
Well, it's all happened on your watch. This has all happened in jurisdictions run by Jay Inslee's party. Remember, we got one party government in Seattle. We've essentially got one party government in King County. Yes, I know of the 9 members of the King County Council, there's a couple of Republicans, but the Seattle political establishment runs King County government. And then, of course, you got state government as well. And some of the laws that they have passed have not made things better, particularly when it comes to drugs. So if Jay Inslee wants to blame someone, start with your own party. They are the only people who have been in charge since this became a problem and since the problem became a crisis. Here's more from Jeremy Harris, Como 4 News.
The governor saying this situation and the nearly 2,000 encampments like it around Washington freeways cannot be allowed to continue.
One way or another, we've got to get this job done. The people of the state of Washington do not accept this squalor in their state.
Well, what do you mean they don't accept it? It's there.
Inslee called on the legislature to push forward a $4 billion bond proposal to voters to fund new affordable housing in the state.
This is an issue that you can't nickel and dime. Baby steps won't cut it. And frankly, I've heard some people say, well, it's just a chemical problem. If they just got off their addiction, we wouldn't have any homelessness. But you got to have housing.
You need housing for the addicts? Is that how you solve it then? Jay Inslee is sounding like someone in the Seattle homeless industrial complex 10 years ago. And of course, the people in the homeless industrial complex from 10 years ago are still saying those things because they have a financial and political imperative to keep saying so. But Jay Inslee should have learned a thing or two by now. This is not a housing problem. This is a drug problem. As long as drugs are legalized and destigmatized in the city of Seattle and King County, these are your results. This is what you're going to get. You're going to get those results here. You're going to get those results in Portland. You're going to get those results in San Francisco and Los Angeles. It's because that's how you're responding to drugs, not to homelessness. This is how you're responding to drugs. You take a hands-off approach and you legalize them and you don't enforce laws that are constantly being broken all the time. So again, this is all about drugs and enforcing the law. You'll notice you don't see these kind of drug encampments in, say, Lake Forest Park or Kirkland. Why don't you see them there? They're not allowed. When these tents go up, the cops show up, say, excuse me, if you need some help, we'll get you some help. But you can't live like that in this city. If they did allow it, then those cities would be covered too. So for Jay Inslee to say, you know, support my bond issue, and we'll explain why that's a terrible idea. And by the way, like I said, I don't think he's going to get it through. He's having a very tough time. We'll be talking about that at 8:05 on the show today. But beyond that, just saying that, oh, this is a housing issue, just shows a complete sense of not understanding why this problem exists the way it does. Birds patiently standing by, time for the Twitter 20.
Yeah, it's going to be somber and then a little bit joyful here on the Twitter 20. The Twitter 20 sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. Today marks the 9th year since the deadliest landslide in U.S. history at Oso, the Stillaguamish River, Snohomish County.
Oh boy.
And there is a memorial set for this morning. This is going to be, and the public's invited to attend Steelhead Drive from 8:30 to 9:30 this morning. A shuttle will transport people that park at these designated lots at Steelhead Drive. There's going to be tents, warm beverages, some cookies available courtesy of Snohomish County Parks. There's going to be a chaplain that will lead a prayer, and South County Fire Department's Honor Guard bagpipers will perform Amazing Grace. 43 people died in 2014 when the hill gave way, the deadliest landslide in U.S. history. So to honor the victims today, family members will speak, read their names, and offer prayers. The ceremony starts at 10 a.m., but you can do the parking at the designated lots at Steelhead Drive there off Highway 530.
Yeah, it's right off Highway 530. Yeah. Signs will direct you. Just to give you an idea of the magnitude of this tragedy, when you're driving Highway 530 from to Darrington or from Darrington back up toward Highway 9 and eventually I-5, when you're on that highway, picture a mud, rock, and sand hill 10 feet high, because that's how high the rock and mud was covering Highway 530 when that terrible slide happened.
Yeah.
It slid all that way across the highway, covered it 10 feet high.
Yeah, and I would be remiss in not reminding listeners that the information I just passed along was from a post by the Everett Herald News website. They had posted about today's memorial service, and again, starts at 10 a.m.
Sad news, an American icon, an American sports icon, Willis Reed passed away yesterday at the age of 80. And he is known for playing through a horrible, gruesome pulled thigh muscle injury in the 1970 NBA Finals Game 7 to lift the New York Knicks to an NBA championship. And the images of Willis Reed coming out of the tunnel from the locker room onto the court at Madison Square Garden really do live in infamy. Here's a little bit of what it sounded like in 1970.
Full count. Oh,
I got the wrong version here. This is Willis Reed.
I think we see Willis coming out.
Here comes Willis. And the crowd is going wild.
Arnett to Reed on the forecourt. Right side from 20. Jumps. Yes. Willis has hit on his first two. He bullets one down. Put it is intercepted by the Busher. Fast break for the next Busher on the drive. Leads Reed and driving shot is good.
Okay, now, do you remember who was on that team with Willis Reed?
Well, Walt Clyde Frazier. Earl Monroe also on that squad?
No, he was on the Baltimore Bullets.
He was Baltimore then, okay.
But Dave DeBuscher.
DeBuscher, yeah. Oh, and then...
a future U.S. Senator,
Bill Bradley.
Bill Bradley.
Who is no slouch on the court.
He's a great player.
Yeah, he was an awfully good ball player.
Bill Bradley, Dave DeBuscher, Willis Reed was the center, Clyde Frazier, yeah. Walt Frazier was point guard.
Yeah.
And, oh boy, forget the fifth member.
Yeah, but Willis Reed became that standard in sports of playing through pain
and injury
to be there for your teammates. What an incredible man.
We have some interesting disclosures from Anthony Fauci that are in this new PBS documentary, American Masters. I don't know why he is considered to be in that pantheon.
I think it's because he has a master's degree.
But more than a master's degree, he was America's best paid government official. And also, of course, has a 40 plus year career in public health, which did not generate wisdom over the years, more of a, you know, kind of a bureaucratic mentality and mixing politics with your science. Here's what I'm talking about. When I think of the pandemic and Anthony Fauci's role, and again, initially, he was almost like, you know, America's family doctor for the first few weeks, even first couple months of the pandemic, talking in very reassuring terms about, you know, we need to bend down the curve. We need to shut everything for a while. And then he started getting more and more dictatorial and political. And people began to see that there was less science there and a whole lot more politics. And the more that he came under fire, the more he complained that people were being anti-science, kept trying to hide behind the science label when he was caught making comments that were not related to science. When I think about the pandemic and Anthony Fauci, a couple of things immediately come to mind. The first is how Anthony Fauci tried to play down the origins of the COVID-19 variant. Why was he? You would think that he would be passionate about finding out the origin of COVID. But it turns out that Anthony Fauci was funneling taxpayer dollars to the very institution that likely was the breakout point for the virus, the Wuhan Institute of Virology in Wuhan, China. So his reaction was not to be driven by science, but to be driven by basically covering his bases. So that's the first thing. A doctor who did not want to know about the origins of COVID. The second thing is that he continued to play down the importance of herd immunity, which is how every disease, particularly every respiratory disease, is eventually mitigated. And when people say, well, I've had COVID, I've recovered, well, that doesn't really matter. What do you mean it doesn't matter? And it was a group of doctors from Harvard and Stanford and Oxford who authored this great essay, this great letter called the Great Barrington Declaration, that said we need to focus our strategy for combating COVID on helping those who are most at risk, i.e., elderly people and people with pre-existing health conditions. And for the rest of the population, emphasize the importance of immunity from within. That is, when you get COVID, if you're a healthy person, you get COVID, you get over COVID, and you are armored, you are protected. Fauci and the public health establishment poo-pooed the importance of, if you will, self-immunization from people having had COVID. I've never seen that before. And he's never explained why, for some reason, he thought that natural immunity was not an effective deterrent to spreading the contagion. He's never explained that. But he did declare war on the highly respected physicians and professors behind the Great Barrington Declaration. So here he is in June of 2021. He's going house to house in the mostly African-American neighborhood of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. He's there with the mayor, Muriel Bowser. They're going house to house with cameras in tow, talking up the importance of getting vaccinated. And the first clip you're going to hear is Fauci and the mayor knocking on a door. A black woman answers the door, and here's what happens. Okay, this is Muriel Bowser talking to her. You should get it first, that way you won't give it to them, i.e. your kids.
I thought I would give it to them if I get it.
No, not at all. In fact, we got to get you vaccinated so that if you were to get infected, you could pass it on to them. So you're actually protecting your family by getting it vaccinated.
Well, I heard that it doesn't cure it, and it doesn't stop you from getting it.
No. So on the very, very, very rare chance that you do get it, even if you're vaccinated, it's a very, you don't even feel sick. It's like you don't even know you got infected. It's very, very good at protecting you.
Just to Anacostia, so get up there. Okay.
All right. See you later.
Okay, what you just heard the doctor say, we now know to be false. We now know that that's not true. That you can get COVID much. I've been vaccinated. I've had COVID twice. I know lots of people who've been vaccinated and boosted who've had COVID.
I am in that category.
And so you can, and by the way, you can get sick. You can be hospitalized. At one point in 2022, more people were dying who had been vaccinated than were dying who had not been vaccinated from COVID. So what you heard Anthony Fauci just say is flat out untrue. And as they were continuing to walk the neighborhood, Mayor Bowser talked about the states where there was hesitancy to get vaccinated. And, of course, those are red states, and Fauci was complaining about them. Listen to what he said.
What are we going to do about those other states?
What are we going to do about those other states, she asks.
Oh, my God. They're going to keep the outbreak smoldering in the country. It's so crazy. I mean, they're not doing it because they say they don't want to do it. They're Republicans. They don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
And we got to break that, you know, unpack that.
They're Republicans. They don't like being told what to do. We need to break that. Again, there's the real Anthony Fauci. And, of course, those critics turned out to be a lot more correct than Anthony Fauci. They were more correct on the issue of natural immunity, more correct on the likely origin of COVID, more accurate when it came to the limited utility of mask wearing, for which Anthony Fauci was practically manic. And again, this PBS documentary is meant to showcase and praise Anthony Fauci. What they're really showing is just how disconnected from actual science he turned out to be. Good morning, Lars
Good
Larson.
Good morning, John, and happy Wednesday. Do you suppose, are you playing that song for Alvin, the DA in New York, who just found out that he just latched onto the tiger's tail, and the tiger is gonna eat him, and Mama said there'd be days like this.
You might want to give the update on this. They're not going to be an indictment today either.
Well, okay, yeah, no indictment today. There'll probably be an indictment at some point, but this is such a comedy legally because Alvin, you know, this idiot who's the George Soros special DA, who's dropped prosecutions by 69%. You think Portland and Seattle are bad? 69% criminal prosecutions down. He decides to take a misdemeanor allegation that Donald Trump falsified business records, which isn't proved, from 2016, meld it with a federal law that says you can't spend campaign money on, say, paying for a non-disclosure agreement with a porn star like Stormy Daniels, which there's no proof that Trump spent campaign money on it. He wants to put the two of them together, create gain of function in a legal sense, yes, and turn it into a felony. And he thinks this is going to catapult him to stratospheric levels in politics. I think it's going to leave him running for dog catcher.
Well, it's going to make him look like the New York AG, and it's going to make him look like Bob Mueller. After all this huffing and puffing, nothing. I want to point out real quickly that Alvin Bragg's predecessor looked into this issue, and he definitely wanted to bring charges. He said, no, there's nothing here to bring criminal charges. That's Cyrus Vance, a Democrat whose father had been Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State. The federal government, the Justice Department, also looked into this, said, nope, nothing here. Alvin Bragg, a year ago when he took office, said, from what I've seen, nothing here. And all of a sudden now, after a pressure campaign, again, he's famous for downgrading felony charges to misdemeanor status. For the first time, he's trying to make a misdemeanor a felony, Lars Larson.
And now what he's going to do that he will be famous for forever, he will be the guy who did the biggest thing to help Donald Trump win the nomination in the summer of next year and win the presidency in the fall of 24. In Democrat circles, that is not a badge of honor.
That's what's called an in-kind political contribution. I wonder if Alvin Bragg will have to list it as such. he could be in violation of campaign finance laws if he doesn't. There will be no arrest of Donald Trump today. And now we're told, no, it probably won't happen till next week because the grand jury's hearing another witness. Look, are you getting as tired of this as I am? It's all such a trivialization of our system of justice. Now, keep in mind, you have someone who not only is a former president, but also someone who is, at this point, the leading contender for the Republican nomination to run for another term as president. And a DA who is famous for dismissing criminal cases against defendants. He's a woke left-wing prosecutor who has kicked down 70%, 7 out of 10 felonies that have been referred to his office have been downgraded to misdemeanor status. And now he is trying, for the first time, to elevate a misdemeanor, an alleged misdemeanor, to a felony. A charge that his predecessor neglected to bring and that the Federal Department of Justice neglected to bring. What this shows, again, is just how pathetically political our system of justice has gotten in this country, where people who really have broken the law and hurt people and attacked people and stolen from businesses and people time after time after time, they pay no penalty at all. While this guy goes hunting for Donald Trump because he wants the headline that for the first time in American history, a former American president was arrested. Arrested for this?
And how does this dovetail with what John Edwards did when he was paying off his mistress?
Oh,
or
charges.
Maybe paying off isn't the right word, but funneling money to his mistress back in, was it 2004, 2003?
No, not only that, he was arranging for her housing and arranging for hush money payments for the child they had out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that whole thing, you know, no charges were brought. No charges have been brought against Hillary Clinton for the discredited so-called Steele dossier, which was basically Russian disinformation that the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee paid for, but they disguised the payments. They funneled them through a law firm, Perkins Coie, Seattle-based law firm, and called them legal charges. That is exactly what they're attacking Donald Trump for. Again, not for peddling misinformation, but for allegedly paying off a porn star that he had a quick tryst with, which might be sleazy, but it's not illegal. They're saying, oh, what made it illegal is that the payments, which, by the way, were not made with campaign money. They were made with personal funds. Those payments helped his campaign. So this really was a campaign transaction. Well, prove it. They say, well, it happened in 2016. Yeah, okay. So he was worried that something like this could go public. The accusation that she said she was going to go public would go public. Maybe he didn't want his marriage to go up in flames. You know, how can you prove that it was campaign related? They can't. It's a pathetic case. It's going nowhere legally, but it's such a nonsensical political sideshow. And maybe the Democrats are thinking, look, anything that keeps Donald Trump's name in the headlines is good for our party because, you know, Trump unifies the Democrats and we don't have to focus on our own differences and, more important, ladies and gentlemen, our own failures. And instead we say, you know, look over there, a shiny dime. Or in this case, look over there, an arrested president. So that's what's happening there. All right. While we're talking about politics, let's bring it all home here. There was a poll last week. We gave it a little bit of coverage. It was the first poll on Washington's 2024 governor's race. And it was done by a liberal outfit, Andrew Villeneuve's Northwest Progressive Institute. I know Andrew. And last year, their poll showed that Patty Murray was likely going to be easily reelected and said that Marie Glusenkamp Perez had a chance of being elected to Congress in the 3rd District. And, of course, she won a huge upset over Joe Kent. So this year, they looked at four candidates. They looked at three Democrats: Bob Ferguson, the attorney general, Dow Constantine, King County executive, and Hillary Franz, who's a former legislator from Bainbridge Island. Now she's the statewide lands commissioner. And they looked at one Republican, Bruce Dammeyer, the former Republican state senator from Pierce County, who is now the Pierce County executive. He's in his second term. And here what the polling results show that are interesting. First of all, 30% of the people who were surveyed weren't sure who they liked. Not all that surprising. It's very early in the going. The second interesting feature is that the leader was the Republican, Bruce Dammeyer. Now, that's because he's splitting the vote with three Democrats, and so 35% of the people in this poll liked Dammeyer, which suggests that the Republican base vote is about 35%. In other words, if you're a Republican, you're running for statewide office, you start out with about 35%. The three Democrats in the race, Bob Ferguson, Dow Constantine, Hillary Franz, their combined totals were 35%. So Bruce Dammeyer actually exceeded all three Democrats combined. The winner, the clear winner, the easy winner is among the Democrats was Bob Ferguson. Bob Ferguson was selected by 21%. So here he's been attorney general now for 10 years, and one in five voters in a poll conducted by a liberal organization, one in five, 21%, said they would like Bob Ferguson to be governor. Only 7% selected Dow Constantine. That's the big surprise in this poll. 7%. Dow Constantine has been county executive longer than Ferguson has been attorney general. You know, the King County is in the business and media epicenter of Washington State. So he's had 11 years of name recognition, 11 years of helming an office that at least two previous governors have held, that of King County Executive, Gary Locke and John Spellman. And he shows up with 7%?
Yeah, and Dow Constantine has 11 years of demonstrably making King County a worse place.
Well, yeah, he's made it what it is. Yeah. Take that for what it is. And then Hillary Franz, largely unknown, is coming up with 7%. She's been in office for about 6 years. So Dow Constantine, and I don't know if this was just coincidental or not, but a couple of days after this poll came out, Dow Constantine notified his supporters he will not be running for governor in 2024. It's interesting. He's not even waiting to see what Jay Inslee does. But I think that Dow has calculated that it would be tough to outflank Bob Ferguson. He's raised, by the way, both men have raised a ton of money. Dow Constantine, you know, just has these easy walk in the park reelection victories as King County executive as an incumbent Democrat. But Bob Ferguson has also been raising big money throughout the state, particularly in King and Pierce County. So Dow would have quite a bit of ground to gain to make up if this poll is accurate.
And did the Northwest Progressive Institute use a polling company
this
poll?
Yeah. No, they used public policy polling.
Okay. Are they reliable?
As I said when I opened the segment, they had predicted that Patty Murray would have an easy reelection. Not just that she'd be reelected, but it'd be easy. So, again, the thing to keep in mind here, the most important thing, is the Republican base vote is 35%. That ain't bad. Bruce Stammeyer has said he doesn't want to run for governor for the Republican nomination. Maybe he should give it a second look. And secondly, Dow just did startlingly poor in this poll and has now decided that he will not run for governor, whether Jay Inslee seeks a fourth term or not. It's coming up on 18 minutes after 7 o'clock, and this being Wednesday, you know what that means. It's our legendary song lyric of the week contest. When you hear the lyric I'm about to give you, be the 10th caller. We've got some great prizes for you, including a $50 gift card to Daniel's Broiler Steakhouses, and also the Blu-ray DVD of a wonderful patriotic movie.
Jesse Brown, U.S. Navy's first black pilot, Korean War. I'm telling you, John, a story we should have learned in school.
The movie is called Devotion.
Yeah, it's called Devotion. It's a true story, and it's about, not only about that, but it's about brotherhood between two guys who are very dissimilar, who became very good friends.
Right before he went from prop planes in wartime to jets.
Jets.
Yeah.
So you'll want to check that out. I've seen the movie in theaters. It's great. Anyway, when you hear this lyric, be the 10th caller, and here it is. I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mine. That's the lyric. I guarantee you've heard it many, many, many times before.
And then
I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mine.
And then the phone number is a little different from past weeks because we're in our new studio. So here is the number you need for the contest line when you hear those lyrics. 206-644-6006.
What's that number?
So 644-6006.
One more time?
644-6006.
There you go. 206-644-6006. That is our new phone number.
Japan defeats the United States last night 3-2, and that is the final out of the game. The Anaheim Angels pitcher Shohei Ohtani, Japanese, striking out his Major League Baseball teammate Mike Trout, also of the Angels.
Yes.
And it was kind of a remarkable moment from this standpoint that I stumbled across from the handle Codify Baseball. And this is a blue verified checkmark account. Dozens of MLB pitchers have trusted Codify's personalized game planning for greater pitching success.
Yeah.
So the handle Codify Baseball said about that at bat last night. Mike Trout has had 6,174 career Major League Baseball plate appearances. So 6,174 times he's come to the plate, only 24 times out of those 6,174 times at the bat, Mike Trout has ever swung at three pitches and missed.
Wow.
But that's what Shohei Ohtani did to him last night that closed out that game in a 3-2 victory for Japan. So,
well, on the other hand, better that this happened to Mike Trout in March
yeah, I guess.
Than in July, August, or September.
I guess.
But
it's spring training.
And the other,
going to be a little rusty. Now would be the time.
Short story of all this: Mike Trout, one of the elite players, and now Shohei Ohtani has been one of the elite players in the last year or two as well, since he came over to the major leagues from Japan.
So you're trying to say the Angels are going to best the Mariners this year? Is this?
I don't know that I said that.
Is that what you're insinuating?
I don't know that I said that. And that's one of the other things that other people have kind of been hopping on from last night's unique moment at the World Baseball Classic is that the Anaheim Angels will probably have a very poor season and be irrelevant in the world of Major League Baseball, but they obviously have two guys that are pretty tremendous frontline players.
Yeah. Yes.
KVI's Ari Hoffman posted this, and since we had this story of the eviction notice in Ballard that turned fatal, Ari Hoffman posted this from a listener about squatters taking over houses and empty buildings, and a listener told Ari, quote, and Ari posted this on his social media, "I rented to a family, gave them a great break, and they decided to squat 6 months to get them out, $6,000 in lost rent and court fees, as well as damage to my property and cleanup costs." And this individual blames Jay Inslee, but I'm imagining that the rhetoric for eviction moratoriums that emanated from Seattle probably have an impact on that as well.
Want to give us a call here at the Commute with Carlson? Go ahead, pick up the phone, 206-644-6006. Again, that's 206-644-6006. If you just happen to be wanting to give us a shout. And by the way, can we give you an update on this terrible story out of Seattle? You have a King County Sheriff's deputy in critical condition. This is after being shot while he and two other officers were attempting to serve an eviction notice on someone being identified by the Seattle Times as a woman named Yusi or Yusitis. Yusitis was 29 years of age. And apparently, Yusi was going to be evicted after falling some $13,000 behind in rent. It's not clear the last time Yusi paid any rent, because Yusi moved into the apartment that she was eventually evicted from in 2019. There was a eviction moratorium passed by the Seattle City Council. Remember that? You can't evict anyone during the pandemic. And they extended it. It was established in March of 2020 and then extended again and then extended again until February of 2022. In September, Usitas' landlord served 14-day notice to pay rent or vacate the premises. And Usitas did neither. Did not have a job. Had no income. So she burned through all the pandemic. She, again, being identified by the media as a woman. Here's the thing. She was not a woman. Usitas was a man living as a woman. She was transgender. And at the very least, in the interest of accuracy, she should be referred to as a trans woman, a man transitioning to woman status. But Usitas, the full name is Usitas, was not a woman. She was not a female. Understand, the progressive left insists that there's no connection between your sex and your gender. If you want to understand the trans world, they deny any biological connection between your chromosomes, your, we'll keep it clean, your private parts, and your gender. Your gender is something that you simply choose. They make zero connection between your gender and your sex. Hospitals are actually under fire by the trans lobby for assuming that a female, that if you're born with female parts, that you're a girl, and if you're born with boy parts, you're a boy. So this is how the Seattle Times is now identifying someone who was biologically a man, who clearly had mental health issues, was also a political radical, a member of Shama Sawant's Democratic Socialists of America, who, by the way, are not Democrats. They do not believe in democracy. The organization, Democratic Socialists of America, has released a statement after, again, one of their members, Yusi, was shot by herself. I'll use her preferred pronoun here, by herself. While being evicted, a deputy was shot. The shot missed his bulletproof vest, hit his, quote, upper torso. And after surgery, he is resting in critical but stable condition. The person being evicted then retreated inside the house and took her or his own life. The Democratic Socialists decried the death of Yusi, quote, "Unfortunately, this tragic outcome underscores the violent character of our capitalist housing system, which prioritizes the profits of landlord over the human right to housing. We will remember and honor the life of Yusi and all those who have been killed by this unjust system by redoubling our commitment to building a socialist future." And the Seattle DSA statement also said that Yusi, quote, "identified as trans," close quote. What I find interesting is the statement released by Democratic Socialists of America says not one word about the shot officer. Not one word about regrettable that this episode resulted in the death of Yusi and the wounding of a sheriff's deputy. Nope, that's not there. We hope the deputy will recover. Nope, that's not there. Not a word from the Democratic Socialists of America of hope, of sympathy, of compassion for the deputy who was shot and almost killed. Like I said, don't think for a moment that the Democratic Socialists of America are about democracy. They are a hate group. They hate cops. They hate capitalism. They hate this country. Yusi was a member in good standing of this organization, Democratic Socialists of America. It is unfortunate that Yusi died. It is also unfortunate that she likely shot this officer and was brandishing a weapon in the first place. But, again, just thought you would want to know that, again, the Seattle Times is referring to the dead person who was being evicted, who ended up taking her own life, her preferred pronoun, as a woman. She was not a woman. She was trans. She was biologically a man. And I don't know why the Times has, the updated story does not qualify their identifying her as a woman by saying that she's a trans woman. I would love to have been there in the newsroom to hear the discussion and how they came to that conclusion. And then misled the readers with that kind of labeling. It is 46 minutes after 7 o'clock, the John Carlson Show. 400,000 students have missed school in Los Angeles because the teachers are illegally striking to show sympathy for other workers, like cafeteria workers, bus drivers, etc., who are waging a walkout. The strike is organized by the militant SEIU Union, Service Employees International Union. And again, the sympathy strike called by the United Teachers of Los Angeles. What is impossible to ignore about this story? First of all, that school district is entirely too big. Just by way of comparison, there's 400,000 kids in the school district. In Washington State's largest school district, that would be the Seattle School District, there's about 48,000. This is just one more reason why parents are starting to bail on schools. They're not reliable anymore. They're not reliable, and they don't put the kids first. Kids are an afterthought. As far as the unions are concerned, schools exist for the adults who work there. They are priority one, not the customers, not the parents, not their children. The unions come first, which means the kids come second or later, further down the list. We have a winner in our legendary lyric contest, Beverly in Stillicum. Congratulations. That is, of course, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Midnight Train to Georgia. It's a beautiful song.
What was the lyric again here? That was a hard one to listen for.
I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mind. It's a song about a woman who's with a guy who went to L.A. to hit it big, didn't hit it big, has decided to head back to the simpler life of Georgia, and she has to decide whether to go with him or stay in sunny California.
And what did Beverly win? And then I'll play the lyric again so you can see how hard it was to listen
to. She wins the Daniel's Broiler gift card, and she wins the DVD to the movie Devotion.
Yeah, all right.
Well, Kirkland City Council last night, ladies and gentlemen, voted to approve using the former La Quinta Hotel right next to the Burgermaster off Highway 520 there to house the homeless. Here's Como 4's Mary Nam.
King County bought the 121-unit hotel off Highway 520 in their Health Through Housing initiative last year. We've reported previously residents protested the move because it's near several schools. City leaders say there are still ways the community can provide input.
This is an important milestone.
We'll talk more about that coming up at 8:35. Number three of the Commute with Carlson on what's going to be a sunny spring-like day, says radio legend Mark Christopher. backed up by a solid consensus of meteorologists and weather forecasters. So very good. Get out there and enjoy some fresh air today. As you know, every day of the program, 8 o'clock hour, during the legislative session, we are talking about what's going down in Olympia that we can do something about. And I always bring in a special guest, Randy Pepple, from the best website on Washington state politics. If you haven't checked it out, do so today. It's shiftwa.org. That's shiftwa.org. Shiftwa.org. Because now that we're past the halfway point, we're beginning to zero in on the truly awful bills that can be killed and other bills that are starting to flounder. And one of them happens to be the signature legislation of the legislative session for Governor Jay Inslee. Randy Pepple, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well this morning, John. And you must be talking about Governor Inslee's $4 billion bond campaign to support the homelessness industrial complex.
Well, yes. And again, he keeps blurring the distinction between affordable housing for, say, young couples or for lower income people and street homelessness. The people living on the street don't have a place to live. Young couples and seniors might be having a difficult time finding affordable housing, but they're not the same type of people. The reason why homelessness is an issue are very different for one group than the others.
Exactly. And that's, he also blurs the line between the reality of state government needing to spend $4 billion and borrow and pay $2.4 billion more in interest to borrow that $4 billion after a decade of Jay Inslee doubling our state spending to a record $65 billion in the current budget. So if he couldn't find the money in the last decade, on his way out the door, hopefully, why would we buy this homelessness plan that adds $2.4 billion in interest payments that your kids get to pay?
Jay Inslee is treating street homelessness like it's a housing issue instead of a drug issue.
Exactly.
And by the, and, you know, if you provided a place for every meth head and heroin tweaker and fentanyl addict, first of all, what do you think their place would look like after about a week? And second of all, why wouldn't every drug addict want to come to Washington State to get free housing from Jay Inslee?
Well, that's the dilemma we face now, John. Even without, you know, adding a $4 billion bonding plan with another $2.5 billion of interest, we already are attracting what I would say is a disproportionate share of those who choose to live outside. And, you know, Jay Inslee's running around right now acting as if he just noticed this. I mean, they've been living on public property, on state transportation land in Spokane, under the freeway, under the I-5 overpass, you know, on Lake Union. In at I-90 and I-5 where they cross. I mean, just living on state land, Jay Inslee has done nothing about it in the decade he's been in the governor's office. And now all of a sudden he goes, oh, I did, look at this. We must do something about this.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, where you been is a very fair question to ask Jay Inslee. Now, Mark Mullett is a Democratic state senator. He is also one of the key senators writing the Capitol budget. And here's what he says about Inslee's plan of borrowing $4 billion over and above the debt limit. This is why he needs to go to the voters in November to get permission to do this if the legislature signs off on it, because it exceeds our debt ceiling. So here is what he says, Mark Mullett. He said Washington would be spending more than 5% of its revenue to pay off its debt. Quote, I think the general thought process is, if we're already having a hard time staying underneath that threshold, don't put more money on the credit card. And he points out what you pointed out, Randy Pepple, that it would cost about $2.4 billion in interest payments on top of the $4 billion borrowed, which can eat up other parts of the budget, which could be spent on other things, you know, like housing. So Mark Mullett not voting for this. There's a very real chance that this goes down because it hasn't passed the House either, has it?
No. And the fact is, John, that Mark Mullett has put a knife in this because he's pointed out the reality of it. I mean, he's told the truth of it. He's not doing photo ops like Jay Inslee. He's actually saying this will harm our state financially. And it's not just him. The state treasurer, also a Democrat, said do not exceed 5% on the debt limit. Mm-hmm. That will harm our ability to borrow money, which will cost us more money. But let's face it, Jay Inslee has never met a taxpayer-funded credit card that he wouldn't use. And regardless of what these guys are saying, what did he do? His fellow Democrats, he went on the attack. I mean, he was reduced to going on to Twitter, and saying, that the Democrat capital budget would take us backwards. I mean, that's what he was reduced to doing. And that tells you the power of this plan is that the Democrats are going, no, we don't need to include it in the Senate capital budget. That's going to be voted on today in the Senate. The capital budget Mark Mullett wrote, it'll be the House will release theirs next week. And Speaker Lori Jenkins has not exactly been praiseworthy of Inslee's plan. So if it's not included in that budget either, then we won't have to worry about voting it down in November, John.
So they got to get it through
on the ballot.
They got to get it through both houses, majority vote, and then it goes to the voters in November, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. And so hopefully we won't even be there. I mean, it's that bad of a bill, John. And the reality is, if Jay Inslee cared about the homelessness problem, which the liberal policies of his party have created in our state, if he actually cared about that, he would have been using some of the record revenue that yep. has flowed in over the last decade he's been governor and addressed it then, not coming to the public now and saying, we need $4 billion, but we'll just borrow it, even though we're still running a multi-billion-dollar surplus.
So if it doesn't survive, if it doesn't survive a committee vote, then it doesn't go forward?
It until they adjourn, John, everything's still on the table.
Okay.
If it deals with money, it's so-called, necessary to implement the budget.
Right.
However,
right.
If it does not get put into the capital budget, it's not going to go anywhere. It will be dead.
By the way, listeners are asking, how exactly is that money paid for when you go above the debt limit and you have these added interest payments? How exactly is that
part of the general fund, John?
It's part of the general fund.
It's what
your sales taxes and property taxes.
It takes away money that would be spent on other things. I mean, the general fund exists, and right now the general fund budget is over $65 billion every 2 years. That's what they're debating right now.
Mm-hmm.
This would just be, part of that, and competing for that $65 billion would be, hey, here's that homeless bond that was Jay Inslee's idea back in 2023, and here's the interest payment on that, and that means we don't have money for, housing now. 2030.
Good illustration. Listen, we have a couple minutes left, and I want to return. This bill is so bad that I actually want to beat the drum on this for a second day, especially since there's a key committee vote in the legislature this afternoon, and that's Senate Bill 5599. It's over in the House. It's passed the Senate. It's over in the House.
Exactly. And John, this is such a bad bill. We highlighted it when it first came up in February, when Senator Marco Elias was pushing it through the Senate earlier in the session, hoping nobody would notice. And then we highlighted his gaslighting on this show about his Seattle Times op-ed when he attacked right-wing radio hosts for making false claims about the state law that requires the state to notify families when they have a minor runaway in their care. He says he wrote the Seattle Times op-ed that the law, quote, stays the same, except his bill, quote, does create an
exception. For the exceptions we create.
Yeah, except for the exception, which totally guts the law. It stays completely the same, John. And that's why Senate Bill 5599 needs to go down. If you cannot even tell the truth about your own bill to pass it, you don't get to pass it. And it's in the House committee today.
This is the culture wars battle of this legislative session, wouldn't you say?
I think so, and it's because Senator Elias has made it that way.
Yeah,
I mean, this was not something that I think the Republicans sought out. I don't think it's something that his fellow Democrats sought out. This is something that Senator Marco Elias has sought out.
Now, the vote was a fairly close call in the Democrat-dominated Senate. So let's see if we can take this bill down in the House. Again, it's Senate Bill 5599, tramples parental rights. So what you want to do is call the legislative hotline at 800-562-6000. That's 800-562-6000. And say, protect parents' rights. No on SB 5599. You want your House members to vote no on 5599. Today is a key day to do this. Want to keep this bill from getting to the floor? No on 5599. Protect parents' rights. The legislative hotline number again is 800-562-6000. That's 800-562-6000. If it's busy, wait a while, call, and you'll eventually get through. And by the way, if you don't know your House members, you know, there's two for every legislative district. Don't worry. The operators, who are very patient and very helpful, will locate your House members within seconds. They can tell you who your House members are. Just tell them where you live, or you tell them the town that you live in, and that will get you there into social media from socialists.
Yeah, it's a story I warned you about last week. The Twitter 20, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. The Pierce County Council ended up voting to increase the sales tax to create $20 million for more affordable housing, or more accurately, more subsidized housing. It's really not going to do anything to make housing more affordable. And I warned you about this last week. The county council in Pierce County voted on this last night. And the former Tacoma City Councilman, who's now the chair of the 27th Legislative District Democrats, is a guy named Justin Camerata. Camerata posted on his social media, major win in Tacoma, Pierce County. Pierce County Council approved 0.1% tax for affordable housing. Again, that's misnamed. It's subsidized housing. And so that's a penny on $10 worth of stuff you buy that's taxed in Pierce County. Apparently, Tacoma already has a tax for this in place, so this won't apply in Tacoma, but it will apply on incorporated areas.
If they already have a tax in place, why do they need another one?
Yeah, for Tacoma, right?
What happened to the affordable housing?
Tacoma problems metastasizing to Pierce County areas outside Tacoma. And, you know, again, in a world where we've got never-ending inflation, this is just more money you're going to have to miss out on being able to pay your own bills.
You know, sooner or later, someone's going to point out that this fever demand for affordable housing is happening in an environment where housing prices have now come down in the Seattle area by double digits.
Yeah.
for, we're now in the second year of double-digit drops.
Decreases, yeah.
In housing.
And, you know, you and Brandy Peppel were kind of talking about this plan with Governor Inslee in the last segment, and it's a misnomer to call it affordable housing. Nothing government does makes housing more affordable. It only subsidizes it more because taxpayers are on the hook.
Talk to Brent Beardall all week long. So glad that he can join us again. We're so happy to feature Brent and our good buddy Brad Good from WaFed Bank last week, and welcome him back after a terrible tragedy almost took him from us, that plane crash in a small plane when he was on his way to the Rose Bowl. A lot of people amazed that he survived, and he's fought his way back and is continuing the journey. But he was here in our studios looking great last week. And Brad Beardall should tell people you took your first airplane flight since the accident last week.
Hey, John, good morning. Thanks for having me back. And yeah, it was, it's one of those things that in my mind I had built up that no big deal. You know, I can get on an airplane, and it turned out it was a bigger deal than I had thought. But at some point, as you go through these trials in life and everyone experiences in one way, shape, or form, you have to decide to get back on the horse. And I'm grateful to have that now in the rearview mirror. It was an uneventful flight, even though I was a little bit nervous, but glad to be here and start talking a little bit about banking.
Oh, right. Excellent. Well, and we wanted to have you back for a couple of reasons. The first is it's now been about a week and a half since the banking industry has been shaking. You know, are those tremors or an oncoming earthquake, or, you know, are things just working themselves out? And I wanted to ask you, you know, a week and a half in, are things in the banking industry better than you thought they'd be, worse than you thought they'd be by now, or are we in a holding pattern?
Yeah, I would say generally we're in a holding pattern, and that is because it was really a crisis of confidence, and somewhat self-inflicted from my perspective. I think I mentioned last time I was on, I applaud the actions of the regulators stepping in and ensuring all of the depositors, both at Silicon Valley and Signature Bank.
Yeah.
But they did that after 48 hours. So there was 48 hours that they said, no, we're not going to insure all depositors. And then after, and that was on Friday afternoon when they closed Silicon Valley Bank. Then on Sunday afternoon, they came back and said, no, we changed our mind. This is systemically important. We don't want to cause a run on the other banks. So we will guarantee all depositors, which I think was the right thing to do. The timing was 48 hours too late, though, and it already caused a run on other regional banks. And the issue with it is people are looking and saying, how much of their deposits are uninsured? So in the case of Silicon Valley, almost 97%. So almost all of their deposits were uninsured. And we saw how quickly the run happened.
Yeah.
So essentially, there, you had analysts out there just doing screens saying, what are the largest banks with uninsured deposits? And then you have those same analysts going out and putting short positions on the bank. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So what should the FDIC limit be on bank deposit insurance? And how does raising that threshold affect the rest of us, Brent Beardall?
Sure. So the interesting thing is it's effectively already raised for the majority of banks' deposits out there today. Because between Silicon Valley and Signature Bank, you have the explicit guarantee of the U.S. government. They've said, we will stand behind all of these deposits. And then you have the what's known as the systemically important banks, which is just another name for too big to fail. And if you look at all of the deposits on those banks, that's roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of the deposits in the United States. So already you have 60% of the deposits in the United States fully guaranteed by the, you know, implicit guarantee of the U.S. government paid for by the banks. And then of the remaining 40%, half of those are already FDIC insured because they're below the $250,000 limit. So really, you're only talking about an incremental 20% of the deposits. And why would, in my opinion, why should we not guarantee that incremental 20% so we have a level playing field that if you invest your deposit money as a depositor into an FDIC-insured deposit, it should be insured by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. That's my opinion.
And I understand why, because, you know, again, you would be seeing precipitating another run on the bank if a bank, you know, fell into the kind of trouble that Signature and Silicon Valley did. But the other countervailing argument, the Wall Street Journal is making it, I'm sure you've read these pieces, is you're also providing a safety net for reckless banking practices.
In that's a valid argument, but that's where effective regulation should come into play, and that's where shareholders should make sure that, you know, their companies aren't taking reckless positions. And that's a job of regulators to come in and say, hey, what you're doing is reckless.
Yes.
And by the way, Silicon Valley was very highly regulated by the Federal Reserve being their primary regulator. And what's really hard is how do you regulate people from making dumb decisions? And essentially, that's what happened, in my opinion, that they took risk, and they didn't take credit risk. They took interest rate risk. And so it's hard to regulate everything.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm a believer that we shouldn't have a concentration of our deposits, you know, 60% of our deposits in this country in just a handful of institutions. That's why I believe in community and regional banks. So you have a diversity.
There you
so
go.
No one bank could bring down the economy.
No, that's a very salient point that needs to be said, because regional community banks are getting hit from two sides. On the one hand, you've got people like investor Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank saying, you know what, technology is making smaller banks, community banks, obsolete, because more and more people now do their banking online. And it doesn't matter to them if they're doing it with Wells Fargo, Bank America, Chase, or with WaFed. It's all online, and therefore, these community banks don't have the resonance with the community that they used to have.
Yeah, can I respond to that one?
Oh, yeah, that's why I said it, your response to
it. So I have a great deal of respect for Kevin O'Leary, but I respectfully would differ in his opinion in that banking is a commodity, right? It doesn't really matter if you're just doing your banking in your mobile app, if you're with Wells Fargo, Bank of America, WaFed, Columbia Bank, you name the bank, right? It doesn't matter until it does. And let me point out the example of PPP. When PPP rolled out, the biggest banks, they were stumbling all over themselves. And the people that made the most PPP loans were the small and the regional banks, because someone, you could pick up the phone and call someone and you could get help. And so banking is a commodity until you need something. And so a banking relationship, in my mind, is something that you just don't have the online banking presence. That is table stakes. You have to have it. I am happy to go toe-to-toe in terms of our digital offering. But if you can have both the digital offering and the relationship aspect, I think that's where you need to be as both a business and as a consumer.
Okay, so I'm going to back you up on this using my own experience, okay? I've got an account with one of the mega banks, one of the big-time banks. And I've got an account with WaFed. And the relationship is different. I do plenty of banking online, but I also occasionally visit the bank, and I enjoy the experience at WaFed. I don't know why it's different. It just is. And so there is a qualitative difference between going to a community bank and going to one of the mega banks. There are plenty of overlap. There's plenty of similarities as well, but there are distinctions. Just as there's distinctions between, you know, going to a small independent restaurant or cafe and going to a national chain.
You know, I could not agree with you more, and thank you for giving us the opportunity. I'm glad to see that our team is making you feel that way, because we believe it does matter, right? And there are differences. And it's not that one is right or wrong. It's just the I believe you should empower the consumer to choose.
So there's another vantage point that the smaller community banks are getting hit from, and I'm hearing this increasingly, and that is there's really a grand plan afoot between the major banks and big government. And essentially it's, you know, you wouldn't have had this problem that Silicon Valley Bank has had a signature with, say, Chase, Wells Fargo, or Bank America. You wouldn't have those problems with those institutions that you had with the smaller banks. We're better off just having a few major banking institutions regulated by the government, almost like banking would be like a regulated utility with a few major players rather than all these competitors. And that politically there is momentum to push in this direction. Number one, do you see that momentum pushing in that direction against the existence, continued existence of smaller regional banks? And if so, what do we do about it?
I do sense that momentum, but I also sense kind of a groundswell of support coming to the defense of small and regional banks. And I would point out an inconsistency I've seen. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, okay, what happened? These failed banks can't happen at these too big to fail banks. And to protect the innocent, I won't name names, but there's one of the too big to fail banks that has 85% of their deposits are uninsured.
Uh-oh.
85% of their deposits are uninsured. So okay. Here we're saying, okay, Silicon Valley is terrible. They have 97% uninsured. Here's a bank that has the implicit guarantee that has 85% uninsured. So that there's an inconsistency there. And then there's a different too big to fail bank that if you mark to market their held to maturity portfolio, they lose about 40% of their capital.
Okay.
So these are not just problems, right? They're industry-wide problems. Some have them more than others, right? But that's the beauty of having a diverse banking ecosystem from my perspective.
Yeah.
One of the things I would call out, last week, Treasury Secretary Yellen was testifying before Congress, and she was asked, I think, by the senator from Oklahoma, you know, if would you step in and help my community bank if my community bank had a run on the bank, as you just did with Silicon Valley and Signature? And she basically just recited the law that, you know, if it's deemed systemically important, we would step in. So it really became, you know, two classes. Is it systemically important or not?
Right.
And I'm very, very pleased to report that just yesterday, Secretary Yellen spoke at the American Bankers Association. And I think her direct quote is that the government is willing to take further action to guarantee bank deposits are safe and secure, and that would include a community and regional banks. So I think she is understanding that we need a vibrant banking sector, and that's a government role and the role of the FDIC, and we shouldn't have this bright line distinction of where your deposits are insured and where they are not.
Last question for Brent Beardall, CEO of WaFd Bank, and that is, I believe interest rates have been raised 9 times in a year. And they're pondering another hike in interest rates today. If you were on the Fed Board of Governors, would you support another hike in interest rates?
You know, if I were on the Fed Board of Governors, I would not. I think the historic pace of the increase in rates from 25 basis points up to 475 basis points in the last year. I think we're all feeling the ramifications of that, and it takes time for that to process, to actually see the impact of that. And then on top of that, you layer on this banking crisis, that the impact of this banking crisis, we're talking a lot about the deposit side, but what about the lending side? What about the credit side? lending will be restricted going forward. That I can tell you, because you have two less banks, number one, and everyone else is pulling in, if you will, on their lending. That's just human nature when you get into a situation like this. So between the impact of what's already happened in terms of rising rates and what's happening in the banking world, if I were on the Federal Reserve, I'd say, I understand inflation is high, but let's just pause and see how this rolls out, because they can always increase rates down the road. The other thing that's interesting, too, if you look at futures, the market is already pricing that the Federal Reserve is going to have to decrease rates later this year. So why increase rates then decrease them later on? All that being said, in all likelihood, they're expected to increase rates today again.
I think you just made a great case why they shouldn't, though. Brent Beardall, CEO, WaFed. The Kirkland City Council has now given its formal seal of approval to King County using the former La Quinta Hotel, which is right next to the Burgermaster when you're driving on 520. A lot of people think it's actually Bellevue. It's technically Kirkland. That hotel would now be used to house the homeless. Here's Como 4's Mary Nam.
King County bought the 121-unit hotel off Highway 520 in their Health Through Housing initiative last year. We've reported previously residents protested the move because it's near several schools. City leaders say there are still ways the community can provide input.
This is an important milestone, but the process is not done. That there is still the working out of the agreement with the provider, the provider selection, the working out of the agreement with the provider, the adoption of the code of conduct for residents.
Right now, there are 10 Health Through Hotels in King County. At last check, 6 are operational.
A lot of people not happy at all about this. Why would anyone vote to make this happen? Well, why don't we talk to one of the council members who did? Toby Nixon, former Republican legislator and one of the guiding lights behind the Washington Coalition on Open Government, is on the council, and he voted for it. So did all his colleagues. Let's find out why. Toby Nixon, you're on Talk Radio 570 KVI Seattle, KPLZ HD3 Seattle. It's good to hear your voice this morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you.
Okay, so why'd you vote for this?
Well, in general, because I support the concept of providing housing for people who are homeless, particularly people who are disabled in various ways. But of course, we're concerned about the proximity to schools, et cetera. We've negotiated with the county for months. And basically, it boiled down to a question of whether we were going to require criminal background checks for every prospective resident or not. And unfortunately, the county chose willful ignorance of criminal backgrounds over having information that might be actionable. But we did get...
That would seem to add to another good reason to vote against it, that the county not only won't do background checks, they clearly don't want to know.
We did get an amendment to the agreement that will have some background checks. So that was a compromise. But I think the city achieved all the other things that we were looking for. And now we have to go forward, see if the county does a better job of operating this facility than they have at the ones in Seattle. And
stop there, Toby. We got some time. Why would they do a better job than they've done in Seattle if it's the same people running it and, frankly, the same type of people who've been living there, homeless drug addicts?
Well, we have a much stronger agreement with the county than any of the other facilities were able to achieve.
Okay.
Because the Kirkland City Council took a much stronger position up front. And so there are provisions, for example, that the city gets to has to approve the operator of the facility. The city has to approve the code of conduct for residents. We have a community liaison so that people in the community who have any concerns will be, have somebody to go to. We have periodic reports on how it's going, and we will have the opportunity to take action to change the way the facility is being operated if any problems occur.
Are these homeless people from the east side, or can they be homeless people from anywhere, i.e. Seattle dumping its overflow on the residents of Kirkland?
Part of the agreement is that 65% of the places in the facility will be reserved for people from the east side.
Okay. Can they, if they're caught with illegal drugs, are they kicked out?
The code of conduct has yet to be written, but that is one of the provisions that the city will be pushing for, is people in the facility can use alcohol and cannabis because they're legal for everybody in the state. But if they're caught with stronger drugs, then that should be something that gets them evicted.
You know, who gives final approval of that code of conduct, Toby?
The city has to approve it.
The city has to approve it. That's a relief. Okay, that's some good news. If this had been the county, then basically everything that you guys said would have simply been taken as advisory and most likely ignored, given the political culture of county government. So what are the next steps? We got about a minute. We got 40 seconds, actually.
So the immediate next step is that the county will do an RFP for people to or organizations to operate the facility. They will select the operator. They will then negotiate the agreement with the operator. And part of that process is the code of conduct, which will have public input. And only after all of that is done would they be able to open the facility.
Let's stay close and keep the conversation going on this, Toby.
Call me anytime.
I really appreciate you making yourself available to talk about this morning on the John Carlson Show.
You're welcome.
You bet. That's Toby Nixon, Kirkland City Council, former legislator and guiding light behind the Washington Coalition on Open Government. Good guy. That is all the time we have for now, believe it or not. It's going to be a gorgeous day. Get out there and enjoy the sunshine. Get ready for Ari Hoffman between 3 and 6. Our good buddy Lars Larson from noon to 3 right now. It's time for Markley Van Camp and Robbins on KVI.
Are you ready?
Jamie Markley, David Van Camp, and